It was just space-time and curvature and no matter. Now, yesterday we started talking about neutron stars, which involves fluids, so that's a little shady already. Today, there were these electric fields, and we were still dealing with binaries. But now comes the real crackpot talk, because I'm going to be talking about single stars. Okay. All right, here we go. So this is about massive stars that collapse. You end up with an iron core at the center of a very massive star, more than 8 to 10 solar masses of the mass of the sun. The iron core collapses to a protoneutron star that is stabilized by the strong force, and you get a shock wave that moves out. But the shock wave doesn't blow up the star. It stalls, loses energy, neutrinos are streaming away. And you need to somehow revive this shock to make a supernova explosion. If you don't do that, you get a black hole. And the question that has been asked for a long time is, what is the mechanism that revives the supernova shock, the supernova mechanism? Now, there's a bunch of mechanisms around. Today, I'm just going to talk about the first one, because there's a recent result by Nordhaus et al. That's a group at Princeton. There's Nordhaus and Adam Burrows, basically. And they have done a 3D simulation that actually explodes. So there's more evidence now that we can actually use this mechanism to blow off massive stars. And I will talk about its gravitational wave signature. So what is the neutrino mechanism? This is the situation you have in a protoneutron star. Here's the protoneutron star core, and there is a region where that is turbulent and that is heated by a neutrino charge current absorption, and then there's matter falling in, accreting, and here's the shock. The shock is stalled, neutrinos are leaking out, and some of the neutrinos are being absorbed. They drive convection, they drive turbulence, and they allow the standing accretion shock instability, which is a hydrodynamic instability due to sound waves amplifying perturbations in the shock front that lead to deformations of the shock front. And this is from a 2D simulation that is that I did. The Princeton guys have done a 3D simulation where they actually found some robust explosions. Right, so this is how the standing accretion shock instability looks. Initially, you end up with something that's spherically symmetric, and then there's turbulence, convection, and the standing accretion shock instability starts deforming the shock. Matter is streaming in, and this thing starts low order first, and then increasingly higher order to wobble around. Right? Obviously, this is going to emit gravitational waves, and there's a number of regions and processes emitting gravitational waves. In this picture, there's turbulence and convection in the core of the protoneutron star deep inside. There is convection and turbulence in the region behind the shock. And all this is modulated by this wobbling of the shock. So the expected gravitation wave signal will be broadband, because you're going over multiple length scales and time scales. The polarization will be random, because this is a stochastic process. And it will be rather low amplitude, because the velocities and the amount of mass involved is actually not very large. So we expect 10 to the minus 23, 10 to the minus 22 at 10 kiloparsecs, if we are lucky. Now, people have done gravitation wave extraction from such simulations. That's a study we did last year, where on the left-hand side you see the matter dynamics, and on the right-hand side you see the gravitation waves you get from that. And the interesting thing here is that when the thing starts exploding, the waveform goes off in one direction. Now, this is a linear memory effect. It's low frequency, so we're not going to see it. But it's quite interesting, because the explosion geometry is encoded in here. Now, as gravitation wave astronomers, we have to ask us the question, how do we extract some physics from this? And we started to go about this by looking at, trying to understand what makes these big spikes here, and what sets the characteristic frequency of these waves. So we did Fourier transforms. That didn't help us much, because they do show some preferred frequency here, but we didn't understand it. So we looked, took a step back and went to stellar convection theory. And we said, well, there's this SASI instability. that leads to rapid downflows of plumes hitting a convectively stable region. In this convectively stable region, they will overshoot, and they will feel buoyancy acceleration. And all this is governed by the Prandtl-Weisela frequency. And you can actually figure out what should be the gravitation wave frequency due to the acceleration that a plume that's hitting the protoneutron star core emitting. And you do this, and you plot this, and you do a gravitation wave spectrogram, and you can actually connect the peak frequencies in that spectrogram at a given time with the frequency that comes from the buoyancy frequency at the interface between convectively unstable and convectively stable region. So that's a probe for neutron star structure. So that's, it's one way of inferring some physics from an actual gravitation wave signal. All right, switching topics here. This is about gravitation wave extraction work, primarily due to Christian Reiswick, who's a postdoc at Caltech, who has a beautiful poster outside that you should look at. In stellar collapse simulations, pretty much, gravitation waves are extracted via the quadrupole formula. Now, there are arguments against it. You can't really define the quadrupole tensor in GR. It's a little ambiguous. Plus, it's not gauge invariant. Now, a number of studies have looked at this, compared the quadrupole formula with other extraction methods, namely Cerulli-Moncrief and Newman-Penrose Psi-4. And they did this for an isolated neutron star that's pulsating. Now, the question is, how well does this do, does the quadrupole formula do in core collapse? And there's two studies that have addressed this a little bit. Sarah Duran did conformally flat simulations that they extended to second-order post-Newtonian. Now, you don't really have waves, but they did a trick that allowed them to get some gravitation wave information. And they found that there's little change to quadrupole formula. Shibata and Sekiguchi did collapse simulations, but they had to go to extreme models to even extract the waves because they found it really hard to extract waves from the numerical noise. And they found that quadrupole formula underpredicts the amplitudes you get from Cerulli-Moncrief. Now we're redoing this using the cactus-based code, and we're focusing on the axisymmetric signal from stellar collapse, because that is actually well understood. The physics is under control. The microphysics is under control. So this would be, the one where we actually want to have robust waveforms from. And we do this with Psi-4 and with Cerulli-Moncrief, and Christian's currently working on doing this with this CCE method. And we're picking three models that have been looked at previously with the quadrupole formula and that we did in 2D and in 3D. And we're extracting a very large radii, which is very computationally expensive because we need to resolve the waves out there. And this is one preliminary result where we show in green the quadrupole formula, in dashed red the Cerulli-Moncrief result, and in blue the Psi-4 result. And interestingly, Psi-4 and quadrupole formula in this peak where 90% of the energy is being emitted line up almost perfectly in this case. And there are small deviations later on. We do not yet understand why Cerulli is predicting something completely different. This is just showing you that actually our waveforms are converged, different extraction radii. These are all still in the star, and it's a problem. There are lots of drifts that we catch, and the only reason we have these nice waveforms is because we are using Christian Reiswig's integration scheme for Psi-4 that you can read about in the poster out there. All right. Now, switching to black hole formation, how much time do I have left? 6 minutes? Well, hopefully this will be good, 6 good minutes. Now, if a star fails to explode, it has about 2 seconds before its proto-neutron star has gained so much mass through accretion that it's pushed over its maximum mass. The maximum mass is set by the nuclear equation of state. We got interested in this, so we wrote a 1D code. It's actually 1.5D. Why it's 1.5D, I'll explain on the next slide. This is GR1D. It's an open source code. You can download it from that webpage. It uses radial gauge polar slicing, which makes things pretty easy because the shift becomes zero. but you get a coordinate singularity at the horizon, so you can't evolve past black hole formation. But it's really easy to write out the hydro equations in flux conservative form, and they are pretty neat and clean, don't have many source terms. Now, 1D is a little boring, so we thought, well, let's include rotation. And we did this by looking at how stellar evolution people include rotation in their models. They're all circumsymmetric, but they have an effective rotation. So we do this by having an effective centrifugal force. We get a phi momentum equation and a source term in the radial momentum equation, and we're actually able to study black hole formation in rotating stars. Of course, it's just an approximation, but it's qualitatively, it gives us the qualitatively correct result. It's very interesting. So this is a plot showing time after core bounds for a bunch of models. This is just how well we conserve mass and angular momentum. And this up here shows you the evolution of the maximum density. So as you go on with time, you accrete and accrete, and the density goes up and up, and eventually you hit the instability, and you see this is just with increasing rotation, the proton-Newton star maximum mass is increased. So we are including neutrinos in this, and in stellar collapse, neutrinos are absolutely crucial. I think they're also absolutely crucial in binary Newton stars and Newton star black holes. I don't believe any of the results of the post-merger evolution that don't have neutrinos. So here you can download multiple finite temperature equations of state. They're in HDF5 format. You can also get the three-flavor energy averaged neutrino leakage scheme. We include an approximate heating scheme here. And we are currently working on a nuclear reaction network, because in a lot of these simulations, there will be, in a lot of these physical scenarios, there will be nuclear reactions going on that will contribute to the EM afterglow of an event. So we're doing this in a large scale, because it's a circularly symmetric coat. We can run hundreds of simulations investigating four different equations of state and, you know, 50 different models from stellar evolution simulations that we plug in. We study when the black hole starts to form. So that's a very interesting thing. Here is a little surprising plot. We can actually make super Kerr holes. Now, this is wrong, of course, because in our approximation, you're not hit by the Kerr limit. The approximation doesn't take that into account. There's something interesting here, though. This is the initial omega of the star as it before it collapses. This up here is the ratio of rotational kinetic to gravitational potential energy. And this over here is the spin parameter. Now, if you pick one that would make a super Kerr hole, like this one, at an initial omega of 3.5 frats per second, if you take this one and you look at where it is on the left-hand side, so it's here, and you see it's here, it is over the instability limit for non-axisymmetric instability. What a non-axisymmetric instability does, it redistributes angular momentum. It keeps the proto-neutron star from spinning up. So that means that this suggests that there is a natural limit that keeps neutron stars from making super Kerr holes, because they hit this instability that forces them to deform into bar shape and redistribute angular momentum. So this is all circularly symmetric, so we can't really trust it, but it's very suggestive. All right, we can do this, of course, also in 3D, and this is from a preliminary simulation that we did with our cactus-based code. As a proto-Newton star creates, makes a black hole, evolution continues stably for tens of milliseconds, and we're seeing slowly a torus form that eventually will become Keplerian. Right now, it's still accreting at a very high rate. So this was a simulation with a 40 solar mass progenitor with some kind of simple neutrino cooling. This is the evolution of the lapse, so it drops to zero, and then here's the mass of the horizon of the enclosed mass. Simulation continues stably for, in this case, 60 milliseconds. We have one for which we extracted gravitational waves that actually went on for a very long time after black hole formation, more than 100 milliseconds. So you get, this is a Psi-4 gravitational wave from this process. You get core bounds. You have some convection and turbulence behind this. And then the proto-Newton star gets pushed over its maximum mass and collapses, makes a black hole. The black hole rings down, and this is what the waveform looks like. This is all very preliminary. We are currently redoing the simulation because we had some resolution issues But it's very interesting that we can do this now. All right, so that's the summary. Do not run over time. We have this physical model of how to get some information on the protonewton star structure based on the spectral characteristics of gravitational wave emission. We did this comparison study, we're still working on this, between quadruple formula and Cerulli-Moncrief and Newman-Penrose for wave extraction. It looks currently looks like that within the uncertainties that we have in all the other components in the physics, that the quadruple formula is just fine for supernovae. We have a comprehensive study of circles, vertically symmetric black hole formation. We find that there's no such thing as a prompt black hole formation. You always stabilize the stellar collapse. And protonewton stars that would make Kerr holes are actually kept at a limit that keeps them from making super Kerr holes. And we have this first preliminary result on 3D GR simulations of black hole formation. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there questions or comments? Good question.
Okay, so so I was wondering if when you compare the Cerulli with the Weyl scalar, could it be just simply that you've got a little residual matter lying around that the Weyl is obviously less sensitive to and Cerulli is highly sensitive to?
So, yeah, this is actually what we're thinking. So we have the test simulation going where we make the grids larger to extract further out. We do see a nice convergence with the Psi-4, but we have trouble seeing that with Cerulli.
Yeah, but Psi-4 doesn't have any reaching, so
yeah,
it would be new, almost.
Ian?
So the Psi-4 that you're using, it doesn't have the matter terms, is that correct? So you're using the Riemann tensor instead of the Weyl tensor?
I hope so. You have to ask Uli because it's his.
It's using the, so it's including the full matter terms. Okay. And the quadrupole result is, I'm just thinking that so one thing that we've noticed is that the Psi-4 converges much better with, much more quickly with extraction radius than Cerulli. The quadrupole result, is it infinity or?
No, it's not at infinity. Oh, quadrupole. Well, it's instantaneous, right?
I mean,
exactly. It's just something that comes from the matter distribution.
So could it be that there's a sort of a low radius effect that's stronger in Cerulli than in Psi-4 in the quadrupole?
I didn't understand that part.
So if you look at the convergence of Psi-4 and mm-hmm. Cerulli with radius, you'll probably find that Psi-4 converges more quickly. And in some sense, the quadrupole formula is at infinity because it's instantaneous.
Yes.
I don't know, maybe something like that.
Yeah, I don't have this plot for the Cerulli waveforms.
Further questions? More comments?